Tonight's breaking bulletins. Hitler's 50th birthday bash blows up. Deepwater Horizon explodes in Gulf of Mexico oil spill. And Spanish treasure sunk by English Navy couldn't catch the cash. Plus, coming up, we investigate the shocking truth behind Loch Ness Monster's diet of haggis and iron brew. This is Newsbang, where the news is always bigger than life.
Newsbang. The unseen announcer's gavel of truth strikes again. Ulysses, 1939.
On this day in 1939, Adolf Hitler celebrated his 50th birthday in style, with a party so extravagant it made Kim Jong-un's shindigs look like a trip to McDonald's. The Third Reich, led by Joseph Goebbels, who wasn't even invited, pulled out all the stops for the Führer's big day.
The festivities kicked off with a military parade, where 50,000 German troops goose-stepped past, waving their rifles in the air like they just didn't care. 62 Luftwaffe planes joined in, buzzing the crowd like angry wasps on steroids. The display lasted 4 hours, leaving some spectators wishing they'd brought a cushion.
Hitler received gifts fit for a madman, a model car from Ferdinand Porsche, which he promptly crushed with his bare hands, and an Annexation for Dummies book from his BFF Mussolini. The city of Berlin was plastered with swastikas and portraits of the Führer, because subtlety wasn't in the Nazi playbook.
The message was clear. We're powerful, united, and very good at baking cakes in the shape of our leader's moustache. But behind the fanfare, minorities weren't invited to the party. Jews and others were told to rain check, as they were washing their swastikas. It was a day of celebration and oppression, all washed down with a glass of Schadenfreude.
2010.
In a calamitous turn of events, the Deepwater Horizon, a semi-submersible, ultra-deepwater, dynamically positioned offshore drilling rig, suffered a catastrophic blowout on this day in 2010. The incident, which was caused by a failed cement barrier and an incompetent blowout preventer, led to the rig's untimely sinking and the tragic loss of 111 lives.
The resulting oil spill, the largest in petroleum history, would go down in history as the Gulf of Mexico's big oily mess of 2010.
The spill, estimated at 4.9 million barrels or 20 million US gallons, or 780 cubic meters of crude oil, was so large that even Exxon Valdez was like, damn, that's a lot of oil. The ensuing ecological disaster decimated marine life, including birds, turtles, and mammals, who were last seen running for their lives in a slow-motion stampede.
The spill's remote location and sheer volume made clean-up efforts as futile as a sieve at a soup-drinking contest. BP's CEO, Tony Hayward, was caught on tape saying, "I'd like my life back," before realizing his mistake and diving into the Gulf of Mexico to clean up the mess with his bare hands.
1657.
On this day in 1657, the English Navy, led by the notorious privateer, Admiral Robert Pegleg Blake, set their sights on the Spanish treasure fleet in the Battle of Santa Cruz de Tenerife. The Anglo-Spanish War was in full swing, with Cromwell's forces eager to loot anything that glittered. The Spanish, under the leadership of King Philip the Indecisive, had been cashing in on their American colonies' riches, which didn't sit well with the cash-strapped English.
The heavily fortified harbour of Santa Cruz de Tenerife was no deterrent for the swashbuckling Blake and his scurvy crew. They sailed into the fray, cannons blazing and cutlasses at the ready. The ensuing melee left much of the Spanish fleet at the bottom of the briny deep. But alas, the treasure had already been offloaded onto mules disguised as llamas.
The English limped away with only a few doubloons and a bad case of scurvy. But their actions dealt a blow to the Spanish convoy system. The lesson? Never underestimated Cromwell's sea dogs when they're after some shiny loot. And always check your mules for hidden treasure.
News Bang, poking the sleeping giant of truth with the stick of satire.
Shakanaka Giles is here with the weather forecast, and it seems the skies over Stockholm are in for a rather dazzling display tomorrow.
Well, if it isn't a blast from the past, tomorrow the skies over Stockholm will be putting on a dazzling display, like a pair of overly enthusiastic bouncers flanking the sun. These sun dogs, as they're known, will be prancing about, reflecting and refracting the sunlight, making the whole affair look like a Swedish disco ball. Quite the spectacle, I must say, though I doubt the good folk of 1535 will be as impressed as we are, probably think it's a sign of the apocalypse or something equally dramatic. As for the rest of the weather, it'll be a pleasant spring day with a touch of warmth like a friendly pat on the back. Just the sort of day to enjoy a stroll through the city, admiring the architecture and keeping an eye out for any other celestial shenanigans. In summary, then, sun dogs and spring cheer. And that's all the weather.
In 1942,
during the height of World War II, German and Italian forces launched a massive counterinsurgency operation known as Operation Trio in the occupied territory of the independent state of Croatia. The aim was to target both communist-led partisans and Serb nationalist Chetniks operating in the region between Sarajevo and the Drina River. Thousands of Axis troops were deployed, and while they were able to temporarily regain control over parts of eastern Bosnia, the insurgents were able to regroup and continue their resistance efforts. Brian Bastable is now on the line with more details on this complex and bloody chapter of the war in Yugoslavia.
As I gaze upon the horizon, my dear listener, the sun dips low, casting an eerie glow upon the carnage before me. The earth beneath me trembles as the thunderous roar of artillery fills the air. The acrid stench of gunpowder and the coppery tang of blood permeate the atmosphere. The battle rages on, a brutal dance of death and destruction, as the Axis forces, in their infinite cruelty, descend upon the hapless insurgents, their rifles blazing and their tanks rolling inexorably forward. The cacophony of war reaches a fever pitch as the crackle of gunfire, the roar of engines, and the screams of the dying merge into a symphony of despair. The ground beneath me churns as the Axis forces plow through the resistance, a veritable storm of steel and fire. The air is filled with the metallic whine of bullets as they slice through the air, seeking their mark. The insurgents, brave souls that they are, fight valiantly, but the odds are stacked heavily against them. They are a motley crew, a ragtag band of rebels, their weapons crude and their armor scant. The Axis forces, by contrast, are a juggernaut of destruction, a relentless machine of war fueled by the fires of conquest. They leave naught but ruin in their wake, their path a swath of devastation and despair. As I bear witness to this orgy of violence, I cannot help but marvel at the sheer brutality of it all. The world around me is a canvas of chaos, a masterpiece of mayhem painted in the hues of blood and tears. For every life claimed by the Axis forces, another rises to take its place. The insurgents are a hydra, a many-headed beast, each head a symbol of resistance, each head a testament to the indomitable spirit of the human will. And so, dear listener, as I stand here amidst the chaos and the carnage, I am reminded of the words of the great poet William Shakespeare, who once wrote, "Cowards die many times before their deaths. The valiant never taste of death but once." This is Brian Bastable, reporting from the heart of the battlefield, where the drama of war unfolds in all its grisly glory.
Adesistetindestun. 1999.
On this day in 1999, a dark chapter unfolded in American history as two students at Columbine High School in Colorado carried out a devastating mass shooting. Eric Harris and Dylan Klybold, both 18-year-old seniors, arrived at the school armed with an array of firearms and explosives, intent on a murderous rampage. The attack began around 11:10 a.m. with the detonation of propane bombs in the school cafeteria, which thankfully failed to explode. The shooters then opened fire, targeting students in the hallways and the library, where they killed 10 people. The Columbine massacre, which lasted over an hour, would go down as the deadliest high school shooting in U.S. history at the time. Now, let's go to our crime correspondent Ken Schitt for more on the aftermath and impact of this tragic event.
Ladies and gentlemen, gather round as we journey back to a time when the world was a darker place and high schools were anything but safe. It's April 20th, 1999, and we find ourselves in the heart of Columbine, Colorado, a once peaceful town that would soon be scarred forever by an act of unspeakable horror. Two senior students at Columbine High School, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, had been brewing up a vile concoction of hatred and revenge for over a year. These two twisted souls were so full of misanthropy that they couldn't stand the sight of their own classmates. And on this fateful day, they decided to take matters into their own hands in the most brutal way possible. At around 11:10 a.m., these monsters arrived at school armed to the teeth with an arsenal that would make even Rambo blush. They planted two massive propane bombs in the cafeteria, bombs that failed to detonate due to some pathetic excuse for luck on behalf of those who survived. But don't you dare think these guys gave up. No sirree. They moved on to what they did best, shooting innocent kids in cold blood. They roamed the halls like two demonic hunters, picking off students one by one with their semi-automatic weapons before finally making their way to the library, where they unleashed hell upon 10 more unsuspecting victims. In total, 12 students and one teacher lost their lives that day. 24 others were left wounded and traumatized beyond measure. And then there were Harris and Klebold themselves, both 18 years old and both dead by suicide after carrying out this heinous act of violence against their fellow human beings. Their bodies lay sprawled across the library floor like grotesque reminders of just how far humanity can sink when driven by hate and despair. The Columbine massacre was unlike anything America had ever seen before. It was a nightmare come true for parents everywhere who feared sending their children off to school each morning without knowing if they'd ever return home again alive or forever changed by acts of senseless violence perpetrated by those who should have been their peers rather than their executioners. And it served as a stark reminder that no place is truly safe from evil when it decides to rear its ugly head. Not even our beloved high schools, where we once felt invincible as children, filled with dreams for our future selves.
1968.
On this day in 1968, a seismic shift occurred in Canadian politics as Pierre Trudeau was sworn in as the 15th Prime Minister, succeeding the more reserved Lester B. Pearson. Trudeau, a charismatic lawyer and intellectual, wasted no time in setting an ambitious agenda, from implementing a new constitution to promoting national unity and a progressive social agenda. His assertive leadership style, however, also contributed to growing regional tensions and the threat of Quebec separatism during his time in office. Now let's go to our correspondent Hardiman Pesto for more on this historic transition.
Greetings, Martin. I'm here in Ottawa on this historic day as Pierre Trudeau takes the reins as Canada's new Prime Minister. The mood is one of cautious optimism mixed with a hint of trepidation.
Pesto, are you actually in Ottawa or is this another one of your fabrications? I need to know if I can trust the information you're providing.
Of course I'm in Ottawa, Martin. I'm standing right outside the Parliament buildings as we speak. The air is crisp. The maple leaves are gently rustling in the breeze.
Very poetic, Pesto. But I'm not convinced. Describe something specific that proves you're really there.
Well, let's see. I can see the iconic Peace Tower looming over me, its intricate stonework glistening in the afternoon sun. And just behind me is that famous statue of a rather portly gentleman riding a horse.
A rather portly gentleman? Pesto, that's supposed to be a statue of Queen Victoria. How can we trust your reporting on Trudeau when you can't even identify basic Canadian landmarks?
You're right, Martin. My mistake. It's clearly the Queen atop that bronze steed. But in my defense, it's been a long journey and I'm a bit peckish. Perhaps we could bring in an expert to shed some light on this historic transition of power.
Very well. We have Professor Alistair Crumpletuft on the line. Professor, as a leading expert on Canadian history, what's your take on this Trudeau chap?
A fascinating figure, to be sure. Trudeau was a breath of fresh air after the rather staid leadership of Lester Pearson. His intellect and charisma captivated Canadians looking for a new vision.
You hear that, Martin? The good professor agrees that Trudeau is just what this country needs, a dashing, dynamic leader to guide them into a new era of peace and prosperity.
I'm not so sure about that. Professor, weren't there concerns about Trudeau's controversial policies and handling of the Quebec separatist movement?
Quite right. His stance on national unity was divisive, especially his invoking of the War Measures Act during the October crisis of 1970. An overreaction, many argued.
Well, you can't make an omelette without breaking a few eggs, Professor. Sometimes strong leadership requires tough choices for the greater good.
There you go again, Pesto, putting words in people's mouths. Professor, I think it's clear my colleague's reporting has been anything but factual today.
I resent those accusations, Martin. I am a consummate professional, simply trying to make sense of a complex situation for our viewers.
Is that so? Then please enlighten us more about this complex situation you found yourself in, Pesto.
Well, you see, the thing is, maple syrup, everybody loves maple syrup, don't they? A Canadian tradition as old as this great nation itself.
Unbelievable. Professor, thank you for your insights. Pesto, I think we've heard quite enough nonsense from you today. More delusion and ineptitude after this.
Alerties, 1939.
In a watershed moment for the civil rights movement, American jazz icon Billie Holiday recorded the haunting ballad Strange Fruit in 1939. The lyrics, inspired by a 1937 poem protesting the lynching of black Americans, painted a vivid and disturbing portrait of racial violence in the American South. Despite facing resistance and threats, Holiday's raw emotional delivery transformed the song into an instant classic and a powerful anthem for racial justice. In the decades since, Strange Fruit has remained an enduring symbol of the growing civil rights movement, its impact resonating across generations. Now, we go live to CBN's Melody Wintergreen, who has more on the legacy of this groundbreaking recording.
In the heart of Harlem, a jazz club pulses with anticipation. Billie Holiday, the siren of sorrow, prepares to unveil a song that will echo through the annals of American history. Strange Fruit, a haunting melody birthed from the inkwell of Abel Mirapol, is about to be given voice by Holiday's raw and resonant timbre. The lyrics, inspired by Mirapol's 1937 poem protesting the lynching of black Americans in the South, have found their way into Holiday's soul. She's taken this potent protest and is ready to unleash it upon an unsuspecting world. Despite the looming threats from authorities who fear its powerful message, Holiday stands defiant, her spirit as unyielding as her resolve. As she steps onto the stage, the air crackles with tension. The audience waits with bated breath as she pours her heart into each note, her improvisational style adding layers of depth to an already profound composition. The room is hushed, save for Holiday's voice, a beacon in the darkness, illuminating the stark reality of racial violence in America. Upon its release, Strange Fruit will instantly become a controversial classic. Its vivid depiction of racism's horrors will stir souls and shake foundations. It will serve as a rallying cry for racial justice, an emblem for a burgeoning civil rights movement that is just beginning to find its footing. This moment encapsulates more than just a song recording. It's a snapshot of America in 1939, a nation on the precipice of change, where voices like Billie Holiday's are daring to challenge the status quo and demand justice. So here we stand at this crossroads in history. As Billie Holiday sings her heart out in Harlem tonight, one thing is clear: this strange fruit will bear seeds that grow into mighty oaks of change. Melody Wintergreen reporting for Newsbang from Cafe Society, New York City.
Newsbang, bringing the universe to its knees with the weight of truth.
Ryderboff reports now on Danica Danger Patrick's historic victory at the Indy Japan 300.
Ah, yes. Welcome back to Sports Watch 2008. We've got a real humdinger of a story for you tonight. Strap yourselves in for the ride of your lives as we head to the Indy Japan 300, where history was made on the racetrack. The year is 2008, and a certain Danica Danger Patrick has just become the first woman to win an IndyCar race. That's right, folks. She's blown the doors off that male-dominated world of vroom vroom cars. The fellas must be red-faced as a strawberry daiquiri. Here she comes round the final bend, Danger Patrick, in that sleek red racer. She's been playing a canny game of fuel chess all race. The pit crew have been squirreling away every last drop like ants prepping for a nuclear winter. And it's paid off. She's still purring like a kitten as the other sad saps are running on fumes. Towards the finish line she goes, zipping past the plucky but beleaguered Ricky the lapdog spaniel. She's done it. A lass has won an IndyCar race. The lads will be rethinking their locker room calendars tonight. What a momentous occasion. I remember back in 92 when I became the first man to win the Wigan World Clog Dancing Championships. I celebrated by chugging an entire bottle of dandelion and burdock and dancing an ill-advised jig on the judges' table. Ended up getting barred from the venue and all its sister pubs for a decade. Ah, memories. But back to Danica Danger Patrick and her historic Indy Japan 300 victory. This is sure to inspire a whole new generation of speed demons in petticoats. Why, I can see the headlines now. Danica Daredevil defeats dastardly dudes. From knitting to knitting it on the track. The fairer sex? More like the faster sex. Mark my words, this is just the start. Before you know it, we'll have women's divisions in all the major racing tournaments. The Wimbledon 500, the 24 Hours of Le Mans, the Monoconomics Grand Prix. It'll be bigger than a hippo in a jacuzzi. And who knows, maybe one day we'll even see the First Lady of Speed herself back behind the wheel. Danica's dangerous daughter dominates Daytona. I can hear the commentators already. Though hopefully by then they'll have come up with some less alliterative names. What an epoch-shattering, record-rewriting day for motorsports. They'll be talking about this one for years to come. Danica Danger, Patrick, we salute you. I've been Ryderboff, and I'll see you next time for another lap around the world of sports.
Up next, our ever-intrepid traffic and travel reporter, Polly Beep, is here with a roundup of the day's most hair-raising road antics.
Buckle up, road warriors, because we've got a real doozy of a day on our hands. First up, if you're anywhere near Windhoek, Namibia, you'll want to steer clear of the skies. Apparently, the good folks at South African Airways have decided to put on a bit of a gravity-defying display with their Flight 228 taking a rather unorthodox approach to takeoff. Pilots are doing their best to channel their inner birds, but I wouldn't recommend trying that one at home, folks. Now, moving over to Singapore, the Nickel Highway is putting on quite the show. Seems someone's been a bit too enthusiastic with their excavation work, and the whole darn road has just up and collapsed. I'd suggest finding an alternate route, unless you're feeling particularly adventurous, and don't mind a spot of spelunking on your commute. And let's not forget the rest of the roads, shall we? The M25 has decided to play a game of hide-and-seek, the A1 has gone on a little field trip, and the M4 is hosting a grand parade of hangar duratory systems. It's a veritable circus out there, folks, so keep your wits about you and your eyes peeled for any unexpected detours or aerial acrobatics. This is Polly Beep, your ever-intrepid traffic and travel reporter, signing off and wishing you all a jolly good journey wherever the roads may lead.
Matteo, 1828.
Time now for Calamity Prendeville's Science Watch. Tonight, we're going to take a trip back to 1828 when a daring Frenchman reached the legendary city of Timbuktu.
Good evening, newsbangers. Tonight we're going to take a trip back in time to 1828, when a daring Frenchman named René Auguste Caillie did the unthinkable. He reached the legendary city of Timbuktu and lived to tell the tale.
Now, I know what you're thinking. Timbuktu? That sounds like a made-up place from a Beatrix Potter book. But let me assure you, Timbuktu is very real, and it was once the heart of a thriving African empire.
But getting there was no easy feat. Caillie had to brave the scorching desert heat, hostile tribes, and even disguise himself as an Arab to avoid detection. It was like being in a real-life Indiana Jones movie.
And when he finally arrived in Timbuktu, he was greeted by a bustling city filled with stunning architecture, a thriving economy, and rich cultural practices. It was like stepping into another world.
Thanks to Caillie's groundbreaking journey, we now have detailed accounts and descriptions of this mysterious city that had previously only existed in the European imagination. And all thanks to British innovation, specifically our ability to make fun of ourselves and laugh at our own absurdity. So next time you're feeling down, just remember, if a Frenchman can travel across the desert and reach Timbuktu, then anything is possible. This has been Calamity Prendeville for Science Watch on Newsbang. Good night.
Newsbang, the only news source that's too big to fail again.
And now for a quick gallop through tomorrow's front pages before we close. The Times, Tondo Chief Scraps Debt, History Makers Write It in Copper. The Telegraph, Henry VIII, I am, following the death of his father. And The Guardian, Antony clashes with Caesar's killer at Mutina. Wait, Marinus, ooh. That's all for tonight. Remember, as the man who stole a calendar got 12 months, the man who stole a lighthouse got a very long sentence. Good night.
Tune in next time for more artificially intelligent hilarity. Newsbang is a comedy show written and recorded by AI. All voices impersonated. Nothing here is real. Good night.